This is The Conversation. It's episode 129 with Helen Toomer, who is the director of the Pulse Art Fairs in both New York and Miami, which we are right on the heels of as this comes out. So that is some pretty remarkable timing. We don't usually get so planned or lucky with events, but maybe you will get a chance to listen just before the fairs get going. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out images from past Pulse Art Fairs, as well as an image of Helen herself. Go check those out at the website. And before I tell you more about that, I want to let you know that the last episode, 128, with Mark Gibson Thomas, was an exchange about ethnicity slash race and art making. Mark, as a black man, has had some very interesting feedback, surprising feedback in the 21st century, as far as expectations about what kind of work he might or should be making. So check that out. And Helen Toomer, my first Brit on the podcast, believe it or not. I can't believe, with the lovely accents that the Brits have, that I haven't had more, but not a moment too soon, and hopefully more to come soon. Before we get to that episode, finally, I just want to let you know that I'm going to be sharing a little piece from the New York Times that you may not have caught as a follow-up to the recent article about the growth of downtown galleries in Los Angeles, the larger media's take on LA gallery scene, and a follow-up to that whole scenario coming up on the back end. In the meantime, let's get to that conversation with Helen. Thank you very much for being here. And by the way, if you are new to the show, this is ostensibly a podcast about contemporary art and its doings, and in the best cases, to sociological and psychological diggings, if you will, that come through the forum of the contemporary art world. Some of the best stuff comes in the second half, but don't skip to there because it's all connected and you don't want to lose your place just by jumping at the last minute. Stay tuned for the back end, and thank you very much for listening. I'll talk to you on the back end. Hello there.
Hi, Michael. How you doing?
Hey, all right, Helen. How are you?
Good.
Okay, well, here's my first question for you. How do you pronounce your last name?
Toomer,
T-O-O-M-E-R. Right, like yeah. The, yes.
Yes, like some people, what was it that I got when I first moved here? Like, it's not a tumor, right? He's that Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's sometimes what I get, but yeah, it's tumor.
Wait, what, I'm sorry, you lost me with the Arnold Schwarzenegger part.
Oh, as some people, you know, he's in a movie where he says it's not a tumor.
Oh, right. It's his exaggerated accent. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay. Am I talking to you while you are, I'm going to guess, because this is seems to be the my intro question, where you are, and I'm going to guess that you're on the island of Manhattan. Would I be correct?
No, I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay, all right. That would have been my second guess. What part of Brooklyn are you in, if you don't mind my asking?
Of course, in Williamsburg.
Got it. Okay, which is actually, some would say, depending on what part of Williamsburg, eclipsing parts of Manhattan in terms of the ravenous appetite of renters slash buyers. Is that possible?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of crazy. I mean, I've lived in and around Williamsburg for, I want to say, 6 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely seen, you know, the prices go up. I mean, we're really lucky. We have a great apartment that's not sort of in the heart of Williamsburg, you know, as in, you know, the high rises on the water.
Mm-hmm.
We're a little further out, so we've got a nice little garden, which is, you know, pretty much a gem, as far as the New York rentings, goes.
So,
I mean, I love it here. It feels like home.
That's great. And you are, I was thinking about this, because I was going through the back catalog in my head of the guests that I've had over the last 4 years, and I think you are the first English guest that I've had, which is really kind of embarrassing, but yeah. and I was just thinking before we began speaking, I wonder if the fact that I'm on the West Coast has a lot to do with it. In other words, if I was based in New York, the odds would be much higher. So I'm thinking.
Yeah, I don't know. There's so many of us Brits abroad now.
Yeah.
I love the fact I'm the first. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And what brought you to the States originally?
I was actually brought over for work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, classic story that, you know, a British kid always wanted to live in New York.
Right.
And I worked in London, and I had quit my job and gone traveling. And I said to the owner of the art fair that I work for, who owns Pulse over here, I was like, if there was ever an opportunity to come and work in New York, I would love it. So he called me up one day and said that he wanted to launch Pulse London from New York. So could I come over and help?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's supposed to be temporary, but then obviously I wangled my way in, and that's, I came over in 2007.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to guess from the little that I know about you that you spend still a moderate amount of time back in Europe, or is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I like to go back as much as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy the art scene and the museums, especially in London.
Right.
But also to see my family. I'm very, very close to my family. So
where is your family?
So my family are based near Southampton,
mm-hmm.
sort of like the southern middle part of England, and where the Titanic sailed from. That seems to be what it's famous for. So, yeah, I go down there. I visit as much as New York vacation time will allow me. You know?
Right. Are we talking more nuclear family or even beyond, bigger than that?
No, just my immediate family, my mom, my dad, my brother, sister-in-law, my niece and nephew.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, all of my, you know, my close family, they all live within 20 minutes of each other. So I'm like the black sheep of the family that sort of fled.
Right. Do they come visit you at all in the States, in New York?
Yeah, they have done a few times. I got married in May. And
Mazel tov.
They all came over, and it was the first time that my brother and my niece and nephew, Finn and Fern, had come over to New York, and they loved it. So that was really great.
Mm.
But it's mainly me going home. You know, I'm the one that left, so I'm the one that, you know,
sure.
goes home more
right.
often.
When you mentioned how you love the museums, you know, and the art going, I guess, mm-hmm. in Europe, I assume particularly London, the thing that crossed my mind is the fact that in Europe, you know, it's much more ingrained in people's lives, art, you know, and gallery and museum going, particularly museum going. Correct me if I'm wrong, right? All over Europe. And the sort of the skeptical angle I have about that is when I go and see shows that are popular here, it kind of gets on my nerves, or it's frustrating, I should say, because it's very hard to see some shows when they get a little bit crowded. You know, like if you go to a,
yeah.
like in New York, I suppose, if you go to a free night at MoMA, you know, or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And here in LA, if you go to just a show that's popular, or you go on a day, you know, a Sunday afternoon, you know, which is one of the most popular times to go, it can be a bit frustrating seeing shows because you've got, you know, you got to wait for people to get out of your way. And I just wonder if mm-hmm. in Europe that gets to be even more intense.
I don't know. That's a tricky one because I've never thought about it like that. I mean,
no time like the present.
Exactly. I mean, you know, whenever I go to like the Tate Modern or the, you know, the Tate Britain, it's somewhat busy, but it never feels so crowded and, you know, so suffocating,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to like a free night at the MoMA.
Right.
So I don't really know. And it's, you know, I do think it's sort of potentially more, or I do think it is more ingrained, you know, the museums in Europe, but you know, I didn't grow up with an art loving family, so I wasn't really exposed to the museums until I was at really at school and taken on school trips.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the thing that you tend to find more at school groups at the museums. I think that's ingrained early on in the education system.
Right. Well, I want to jump forward to, you are the director of Pulse, as the intro probably alluded to for people who don't know. But mm-hmm. I want to talk up to you about the gallery that you ran prior to your Pulse work, or maybe you were doing both at the same time. But in any case, it's very interesting to me that in your bio, in your various bios, wherever one finds them, it says that you ran a gallery on the Lower East Side from, you know, 11 to 13, was it? Something like that?
Yeah.
But it doesn't say what the name of the gallery is. And based on the little that I know about the story there, you can maybe see where I'm going with this. I wonder if that has something to do with it.
Yeah, the name of the gallery was Puma Labster,
and
I opened up the gallery with a partner who was my now ex-husband.
Right.
And we opened up the gallery, and I was really the driving force because I'd always wanted to have a gallery, and I was the one who was sort of in there day to day. But as the marriage broke down, the partnership broke down, and then, you know, really I was running the gallery by myself. And I said it before, it's like the gallery was the best of times and the worst of times. You know, I loved it so much. It was magic, but it was also really, really difficult, not only from, you know, a financial standpoint, you know, trying to sell works, to make money, trying to sort of understand the expectations of, you know, the artists and the collectors and people in your, you know, in the art community. And, you know, and being there, me, myself, sort of in the gallery space, sort of alone every day, I found much more difficult than I had anticipated.
Right.
So, I mean, again, like I loved it, and it's no secret that I started it with Chris.
Your ex.
And it just didn't work out, but I don't regret any minute of it.
Well, just back up for a second. When you and Chris started it, what was it, kind of a you're the creative side, he's the business side kind of thing? Was it not quite that clear cut, or?
No, it was kind of, you know, he was an art student, and he'd come out of Goldsmiths in London, and he was, you know, interested in continuing to be a practicing artist and photographer. And I was sort of the driving force behind opening a gallery. I guess I should kind of premise this as well with the fact that, you know, it was my dream to open up a gallery.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of, in my mind back then, I was working towards it happening,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to it happening when it did. It was one of those moments that I had met with a friend, and he let me know that the space next door to his office might be available for rent, and we'd just been having this talk about, you know, what do we want to do with our lives. You know, he's asking me what I wanted to do, and, you know, I said one day I'd love to open up a gallery, but really I've got to, you know, save some more, do some more research and all that jazz. And then I went into the space and just saw it, like, you know, I saw the gallery, like completely fell in love with the space. And the woman who was renting it at the time, she was like, you know, do you want to take this space? She's like, I'm transferring my business online, so do you want it? So, you know, it was expedited, let's say. So I sort of did a quick business plan. I'd had some savings, and I was kind of like, let's do this.
It sounds a bit like your ex was a partner more in name than in practice.
I mean, it's always a tricky thing. That's a tricky thing to answer. I mean, that's the way that I felt. It probably wasn't the way that he felt. Mm. But, you know, as with partnerships that break up, there's always two sides to every story, right?
That's very generous of you. So it sounds, my sense is that you actually knew each other back home or in England before you came over. Oh, you met in New York.
Yeah, we met in New York. Mm-hmm. We got married after 9 months and then opened up the gallery a few months after that. So, you know, everything was very quick. You know, classic New York, you know.
Right.
Everything's on speed, like everything's faster and bigger and all that jazz.
But is that, even though for the across most of the, you know, levels of, or most of the categories, things are faster. When it comes to young people getting married, that's usually not high up on the list. I mean, was that, I guess, based on what you said, you don't regret, you know, any of that. But I don't know, if you had to do over again, would you maybe live together for a little longer before you got married?
No, I don't regret anything that I've done. I don't think you can look back and be shoulda, woulda, coulda. I mean, you should only look forward, right?
Right.
You can only learn from what you've lived. And so, no, I wouldn't have changed anything because I would be a different person now. So
right.
Who knows what those decisions would make. So always eyes forward, you know?
Yeah. I guess it's hard then having a conversation like this where I'm asking you things about things that have not that are not happening in this very moment.
Oh yeah, I mean it's just I wasn't expecting this line of conversation, but like I said to you, I'm you know, there wasn't anything that you couldn't ask me.
Right.
I'm very, you know, very open person. If I can answer the question, then I will. It's just, you know, it's, again, like I said, I think that everything informs the person that you are now. And,
sure.
You know, having that marriage and, you know, having that gallery, it's all, you know, it's, you know, it informs what I'm doing now.
Sure. Yeah. No, I think the reason that I started asking about it and, you know, this was, part of your history that was told to me is because it's interesting thinking about, you know, a gallery that is run by a married couple, you know, and they split up and then the gallery splits up. And
yeah.
And as you're talking about it, it's obviously nowhere, you know, kind of on the other end of the spectrum of sensational. It's not sensational. It's actually a series of complicated events, both with the gallery and with the relationship, and
yeah,
you know, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always, you know, when I was transferred over here, like I said, I worked for Pulse, and one of the things that I loved is I loved working with the galleries, and then there were a lot of galleries who were run by couples, married, straight, gay, you know, and I always thought I always really admired that because, you know, I really enjoyed sort of, you know, talking with them and sort of getting to know them more. And, you know, one would play good cop, one would play bad cop, one would be more artist. Or, you know, it was just very interesting. So that was always something that I sort of aspired to have. But, you know, as with everything, it doesn't always turn out the way you think it's going to.
Yeah, but meanwhile, as you're saying that, what I'm thinking is the fact that you did run a gallery gives you a huge amount of credit toward the gallerist that you work with now as an art fair director.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, there's that level of understanding and empathy there from having had a gallery. So I'm able to, you know, talk to the gallerist on a level that I actually understand that I'm not just, you know, making it up.
Right.
Like, you know, trying to give them the sales pitch, like, you know, I understand, but actually I do.
Right. Well, speaking of Pulse, why don't we sort of, without getting too pedantic about it, do a sort of a short history of it. From my perspective, And I could be very wrong. I seem to first remember hearing about Pulse in association with Miami. But in any case, it is a satellite art fair, which is to say, in New York and Miami, it is in a location near but not exactly part of the sort of quote-unquote main art fair, like in Miami, Basel, and then, you know, in New York, the Armory. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, yeah. I mean, you know, like you said, by nature, it's a satellite fair, so it takes place in Miami. It started in 2005, and, you know, alongside Art Basel Miami Beach, and that's why Pulse and all the other satellite fairs are there, because of Art Basel Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with Pulse New York in March. We align with Armory Arts Week, which, you know, is a what art week because of the Armory show. So yeah, we're there because they're there.
Right. And you being on the, you know, I have to admit, I don't know the New York geography as far as the fairs, but I know that the Armory is on the pier and you're on a pier as well. So are you not that far away from them?
No, we are not on a pier. We are at the Metropolitan Pavilion, which is in West 18th Street,
mm-hmm.
Between 6th and 7th Avenue. So it's sort of more centrally located in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Got it. My mistake.
No,
I thought I had seen that somewhere, but maybe that was something else. And how long has Pulse been around in its New York incarnation?
It started in March 2006.
Okay.
So this is the 11th edition.
Wow. So in addition to Miami, it's been in New York for a while.
Yeah. I mean, it launched like straight after. So Miami launched in December 2005.
Mm.
And then in March 2006. It launched in New York. So, yeah, it's been going quite a while as far as art fairs are concerned, considering sort of like how many have popped up over the past few years.
Right. And I want to see if we can talk about this in a way that, you know, doesn't feel too much like the job that you do on a regular basis. But how would you... I want to try to ask the question in a way that it leads to, you know, an answer that you get to be sort of more free flowing with. But basically, the question is, how do you describe the sensibility of Pulse, you know, as far as, I mean, when you have many galleries, I guess it's pretty hard to describe compare similar sensibilities so much as levels of intensity or, you know, how big the programs are, you know, that's kind of a commonality. But is there a way to also talk about the sensibility creatively?
I think that's a difficult one to answer in terms of... I'm trying to think like about in terms of the sensibility. I mean, people describe Pulse as fresh or as a place to discover artists and artwork.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of has that sensibility, I guess, not a stoic one. It's a welcoming environment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a mix, you know, it's a real mix of galleries and artists. You know, from all over the world. I'm not sure how to depict.
No, that's.
It, you know,
I think that's no. That I think that's a really good starting point. And how different is the galleries that you work with in New York, say, from Miami? Because looking at the list of galleries, it seemed to be New York and Germany and Austria kind of heavy. If that's fair.
You mean in New York?
Yeah, that seemed to be that was what I recall from the list of galleries in New York, and I'm just wondering if that sort of geography or demographic changes substantially for the version that's in Miami.
No, I mean, New York's a smaller fair than Miami.
Mm.
So that changes it, but in terms of where. Sort of people in terms of like where the galleries come from, I don't think it really changes it. I mean, we have galleries that come from Europe. We have a new gallery coming from Hawaii and South Africa this year that haven't exhibited with us before. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting, and it changes all the time. Just based on kind of what the galleries have got going on and where they'd like to sort of have a presence. You know, a lot of the New York galleries would like to do Miami, but not necessarily New York if they have a space in New York.
Right.
Because they obviously try and get people to come to the gallery as opposed to sort of paying for the art fair too.
Yeah. Well, one of the question that raised for me as you were describing that is when a gallery is, say, interested in showing with this Pulse coming up in New York, are they presenting you with the artists that they will be showing in their booth or group of artists that they will be showing, specifically, and that's part of the application to you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They have to apply. They have to apply with the artist or artists that they want to show, and then we meet with the committee, and then the committee goes and reviews, and then we go back to the gallery and sort of say, yes, great, you've applied with these four artists, come exhibit with these four artists. So we go back and we're like, actually, we think maybe these two artists would work better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a dialogue between us and the galleries, because. We also, have an understanding a little bit about, who's coming in New York and kind of, what I think works, what might work well here, for them. And, and then it's interesting having a conversation with them because they're like, well, actually, I'd really like to bring this artist because, I already have like a collector base here or, I have a curator who's interested that I'd like to bring to the fair. So all things that we discover after conversing with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you are having these meetings with your colleagues, sort of apart mm-hmm. from the galleries that are applying to your fair, is it heavily consensus based? Like everybody, you got to have everybody basically thumbs up or thumbs down, And to what extent do you, as the director, have any kind of veto power or anything along those lines?
I think like with all votes, it's the majority vote versus mm-hmm. sort of absolutely everybody. I mean, there's certainly. I'm certainly very, I will obviously speak my mind, as will the committee, which are great. I've been working with these galleries now for 2 years, and then some of them I have even been working with since like 2007 when mm-hmm. I used to work at Pulse, or I've been going to their galleries, even when I had my gallery. So I might have a little bit more of background information about the galleries and about the artists. So sometimes that's really good, and maybe I'll push for a gallery or an artist or artists more because of that information.
Mm-hmm.
But I've certainly been outvoted, which has been interesting. But that's what you get when you set up a democratic voting, right? I can't always have it my way.
I can't help but wonder what the word interesting is a euphemism for in this case.
All right. Yeah. I'll just keep on letting you wonder about that.
Yes, right. Well, speaking of diplomacy, how is that like a huge part of your job, would you say? Diplomacy?
Sorry, what a huge part? I'm sorry.
You missed my whole joke there. I said, speaking of diplomacy, is diplomacy a really huge part of your job?
Oh, diplomacy. Again, I'd never thought about that. No, I mean, I guess with the, with the committee, it's diplomatic, but, I don't know whether it's more diplomacy or whether it's more exchange. Mm. You know, like, mm-hmm. I can't do my job without, you know, without the galleries. And I can't do my job without the team, you know, in the office.
Right.
You know, so it's all about, it's all about an exchange and understanding, I guess, rather than, you know, diplomacy per se, if you know what I mean.
Well, if once the fair is going, let's just say this, mm-hmm. this comes to mind, and maybe this is a lame sort of irrelevant example, but let's say one of the galleries is really unhappy with their booth or, you know, or whatever. There's some kind of, issue that a given gallery wants handled. Are you hands on, you know, with that situation, or is this kind of maybe something that a fire that one of your staff puts out?
No, I mean, I'm pretty hands on. I mean, you know, the galleries have direct access to me,
right?
You know, and you know, I feel very strongly if they're, you know, they've got to be happy in. And that's how basically, you know, one of the ways I see value in my job, if they're happy, I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously we try and address everything head on if somebody has an issue. And there's also, you know, Team Pulse, you know, are on the floor and on site at the fair at all times as well. So we're pretty, like, welcoming. You know, the ladies that I work with are rock stars, and they basically, you know, make sure everybody's got everything that they need and that they're taken care of, because it's really bloody hard being an exhibitor.
Mm.
It's really quite challenging.
Yeah.
I think having exhibited before at an art fair,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's, you know, you're sat in a box for 4 or 5 days. So anything that we can do to make their experience better and more seamless, which will keep them happy, which will give them more energy, which will hopefully more energy will lead to more sales. You know, it's all part parcel to making the fair a success.
Sure. And of course, you've raised the question or the image of, you know, your doings during a fair. While the gallerists are basically, for lack of a better description, of course they wouldn't put it this way, but, you know, stuck in their booths, you know, until they have breaks. But are you basically flitting from, you know, space to space, kind of perusing the whole event to sort of see how things are going, or are you maybe in a base that you are then summoned from one place to another? Kind of situation.
Yeah. So basically, for example, like in Pulse New York, I will be on site at the fair every day.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be an afternoon where I will go out and I will visit some of the other fairs. Because obviously there are exhibitors at some of the other fairs that we work with in Miami who aren't in New York. So I need to go and see them as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's like, you know, I don't like to be, you know, away, you know, from the fair, because we work so hard, you know, for it year round. And then, you know, want to make sure all the galleries are taken care of. But that's really where the team comes in, you know.
Right.
And so it's not just me. It's them and, you know, their relationships with the galleries too. But it's also important for me to see other things. But, you know, my main priority is our galleries. So I feel like it's important for me to be on the floor and to let them know that I'm there.
Mm-hmm. Right. I have to imagine that the Miami Pulse experience is got to be a lot more exhausting and involved than New York for so many reasons. And, you know, I mean, maybe you could paint a little picture of what that's like for you.
Well, you know, in New York, we have a venue, so we go into a building. So, you know, the build out is pretty minimal because it's just bringing in the walls and the lights and the galleries, then bring in the artwork. Mm. In Miami, we basically have like an open space of land. So we build the tents, you know, we bring in the power, put down the floors. Like it's a huge outlay, you know, and that sort of takes place. I would say, you know, it takes place maybe a month before the fair opens just to build.
Wow.
Logistically, it's much more intense. Also, you know, the week in Miami seems to be much more intense than, say, Armory Arts Week, because we're all used to the energy of New York anyway. There's so many other things going on, whereas in Miami, you feel it. You feel everybody descending there for this, for the art week and for all the fairs and the parties and mm-hmm. the events and the meetings. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly challenging time-wise and, you know, physically for us and for the exhibitors and for the visitors, you know, which is why... You know, it's, you know, they're tired too. They're trying to run around and see everything and be
right.
part of everything. So that's the other thing that I have to think about is, you know, are there enough seats? You know, can we build a nicer spot next to the ocean that they can overlook and chill mm-hmm. out? Can we mm-hmm. build charging stations for them so they can get their work done or, you know, post their selfies and, you know, all that jazz. So, yeah, it never ends.
So when you're in Miami then, and, you know, let me put it this another way, because you had mentioned earlier that one mm-hmm. of the things that you're doing is going to see your exhibitors at other fairs. So when you're in Miami, how many of the other fairs have you recently been going to, you know, keep up?
Well, in Miami, actually, I only go to visit Art Basel.
That's nice.
And Design Miami, actually. Mm. I think that's a gorgeous fair. But because it's so sort of intense and because we do a lot of programming and because it's bigger, I tend to find it's much more difficult to get away.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also the traffic in Miami. So, you know, it's not like New York where you can pop out for an hour and actually be back in an hour. You know,
right.
Miami, if you go out, it takes some time. But yeah. I do like to try and go to some of like the, you know, the breakfasts in the morning at like, you know, the Margulies or the Dela Cruz's or going to visit the exhibition at PAM.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always the evenings in Miami, you know, there's always the parties where I'll see people.
Sure. So are you doing a party every night when you're there?
No, I mean, that's, I think that's what everybody thinks that I'm doing, but no, I try to go to as much as possible, but my young party days are long gone.
Yeah, right. That's good to hear. I think what I was thinking more, not so much like, oh, you know, what kind of appetite for party do you have, so much as, you know, as somebody who is deeply professionally invested in this event, you know, you need to maximize that time that you're there. So every evening, I mean, here's the way, you know, this who you mentioned when we spoke earlier, Steve Shane, mm-hmm. the collector described it, you know, going to dinners with people. So maybe rather than, you know, going to all the big events that are in the evening, that you're actually spending dinners with colleagues / clients. And yet, even if you are doing that, which sounds relatively mellow, I imagine that too can be exhausting.
Yeah. Yes to all the above.
Oh, good. I just put all the words in your mouth and you agree with them.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Well, let's see. I'm trying to think if there are other aspects to the art fair that would be interesting to uncover. Let's see.
Hmm.
Okay, yeah, here's one.
Okay.
Particularly with Miami, but maybe you mm-hmm. can compare between Miami and New York. There is the line or the sentiment, I should say, that
mm-hmm.
artists don't go to art fairs, you know.
That
doesn't really seem to be completely true, because I have certainly heard about artists going to Miami. You know, there's like there's somebody like William Pohida, you know, who goes and tries to do some kind of, social engagement with the whole thing. But then there are a lot of artists who will say that they're going because their gallery's there and they want them to be there, and they're just kind of like fucking off to, you know, in the hotel or whatever. But then why go at all? So I don't know. What is your experience and understanding of the artists there?
Oh, I think it's a total mixed bag.
Yeah.
I know artists who are just like, hell no, like, I hate art fairs, I don't want to go. But, you know, I think the general, you know, when I talk to them, I'm like, I feel like it's, you know, it's an important part of the art market. You know, if you're an artist and you're committed to your practice and you want to sell, then I'm pretty sure that the art fairs are going to be part of your future, you know, because if you get picked up by a gallery is probably going to be selling an art fair. It's like part parcel. It's also, you know, about being part of the conversation. I mean, you know, it happens every year. You know, people, crikey, in August start talking about, like, are you going to Miami? You know, or like, how is your trip to Basel? Like, you know, are you going to FIAC this year? You know, it's like part of that conversation, not just for the collectors or the galleries, but sometimes for the artists too. It's a mixed bag.
It really seems like, if I could just jump in, if you don't mind. It seems to me, though, that if you're talking about these artists, quote unquote, being part of the conversation at the fairs, that you're really talking about the upper echelon artists who, you know, it wouldn't really maybe make that much of a difference if they went or not. But if they do, then, you know, then they can be part of Sarah Thornton's book. You know what I mean?
Yes, there's definitely, like I said, it's a mixed bag, but yes, definitely there are those artists of that sort of, but when I meant like, maybe not, I said being part of the conversation, maybe it's like being able to converse about the art fairs,
right?
You know,
right.
I mean, that's kind of what I mean. It's like,
sure,
you know, you know, like when people, when there's an epic show up, like, you know, the Picasso sculpture show that was just up, it was amazing. And, you know, everybody was talking about it. And,
right.
You know, I felt that I could talk about it because I'd been and I'd seen it and I'd experienced it and I loved it, you know. So that's what I mean, just being able to go, have an opinion, like, hate it, tear it to shreds, talk about why you never want to go again. But, you know, I think it's good to have an opinion. I'm certainly not saying, you know, fly to Basel on a jet, you know,
Crikey indeed. I think for myself, and I'm hoping that you will agree that other artists would share this feeling. I would rather have people be my proxies, you know, at art fairs, and, you know, I'm happy to rely on their assessment of a given art fair, or at least parts of a given art fair, and I will have my opinion reserved for other parts of the art world other than the art fairs.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. If, you know, that suits you, and you know, if you've got somebody or some people that you rely upon, and also now with social media, you're able to see and experience a lot more through other people's and organizations' eyes, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, one of my other feelings about, my own personal feeling, I should say, about art fairs is it's just such, you know, a gauntlet of work. And it kind of, I think the best viewing experience and the best viewers of an art fair have absolutely tremendous filters. So I wonder if you, you know, being a veteran, you know, and professional in it, have recognized that your filter has matured and, you know, and gotten better over the years. So that you can, so basically what I mean by that specifically, to be absolutely clear, is that you can completely, you know, filter out the stuff that you really don't want to have taking up any of your bandwidth and hold on to the stuff that means the most to you.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of what you're talking about as well, I think, is fair fatigue, right? Because it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
And there's so much to see. And you're right. There's like, you know, there's so much noise. I think, you know, for me, I go to so many art fairs, and you're right, you know, I tend to do the, you know, I will normally walk around an art fair sort of quite quickly, but sort of won't miss every aisle, and then sort of like make notes, and then I'll go back and look at the artworks, and then converse with the gallery if I'd like to have a conversation with them or learn more about the artist. So yeah, you're right. Maybe, you know, I have developed more of a filter system for it, but you know, that's part of my job as well. Is like, I want to create an environment for people where it's not so overwhelming, so, you know, people can have breaks, you know, and sort of rest and recharge and then get back to it. But, you know, it's not the environment for everybody, but it is really great at being able to see, you know, a lot of work from galleries that you might not be able to, you know, you might not be able to visit because you're not in the same country, or you might not be able to visit because you're too lazy to go out on a Saturday in Chelsea.
Right. Absolutely. So. Yeah. Well said. I think it really meets the needs of a lot of art goers, in those kinds of ways. What about you and collecting? What is your collecting situation, and how does it, you know, tie into what you do?
I love having artwork around me. I love it. If I have more money to spend, I would have more. I would definitely have more artwork.
Amen to that.
Exactly. my collection is a total mix. It's like a total mix of, you know, like a little painting that I tend to buy paintings sort of on my travels, like the Dominican Republic or the Bahamas, or we just came back from Peru. And I like to buy, you know, paintings by artists, you know, who are off the street or off the beach, if I like the way that they look. And then I'll pair them. Like you talked about Poe Hyder earlier, and you know, yeah. I'm just looking at one of his prints that we have now, alongside, you know, a watercolor by a young British artist called Mia Taylor. So it's completely eclectic,
right?
And I love being, yeah, I love being around it. But you know, I tend to buy sort of like one big piece, what I would call a big piece. For me, it would probably be under $5,000. In Miami or around Miami. So that's kind of like where I think about like my annual spend. Mm-hmm. But then I collect smaller, you know, more inexpensive works, you know, and prints. If I fall in love with them.
Right. So it sounds like from what you were describing, your work is coming as much from travels off the art world beaten path as it is inside.
Yeah. I mean, I get so much from traveling and experiencing different parts of the world. That's something that really sort of re-energizes me. And I think that's something, maybe it's because I'm a Brit, and we sort of take our holidays more seriously, than, you know, the Americans, especially New Yorkers who work so hard.
Right.
But for me, it just gives me a whole new breath of life. Like I said, we spent 2 weeks in Peru, sort of like, you know, running around and hiking and visiting the ruins. And, you know, I get as much satisfaction out of that as I do from, you know, going to the Tate or MoMA or Whitney. It's all visual, isn't it? It's all visual stimulus.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. The description of your sort of passion, you know, to use an overused word about collecting, your collecting philosophy, you know, sounds very healthy. And it's what's implied in the way you describe it is that you're not necessarily concerned about market value. And I wonder, that raises the question for you as a art fair professional, to what extent you are aware of investing collecting, you know, both in person and the online version.
Yes, I definitely am aware of, you know, of investing. I don't think that I am sort of like, you know, at the level monetarily wise speaking, where I know that I can make a surefire investment, you know, in a work that's going to, you know, maintain its value. Like, I'm not going to be able to buy a Picasso or a Francis Bacon or a Monet, you know, that, you know, those kind of things. But, you know, I do believe that you should buy what you love, especially in the, you know, especially because you're living with it. And it's, you know, it's kind of exciting, you know, when you buy artwork from a young gallery of a young artist, and then you see that artist rise. Like, I wouldn't sell any of the work that I own, even if one of them became a rock star and, you know, there's a super high demand. Because I'm too sentimental about the works. Like, every work that I have has a story.
Right.
But going back to your point, like, yes, I do think that people are definitely more aware of what's an investment. And I think that that's where research comes into it. And I think, you know, online platforms like Artsy and just, you know, even Google or Instagram, you know, it's good to do your research. And, you know, again, you know, it's also good to talk to the gallerists. You know, I think it's really important to be able to have that, you know, honest dialogue, like, how long have they been working with the artist? You know, what's the artist's bio, you know, and just get an understanding of the history of the artist and the gallery so they feel comfortable investing in them, you know?
Again, implicitly from what you're saying, I'm gathering that the really cynical type of flipping art, that culture of the art world, is something that's not, that's just, you know, being reported, and that you're aware of that way. It's not really something that you're confronted with in a direct form. Is that fair?
No. Yeah, totally fair. I know it's out there. I know it's happening.
Right.
But yeah, it's just not part of my world.
Right. And I love, by the way, that, and I hope it's absolutely true too, that you would hold on to an artist's work despite the fact that they became superstars, you know, because of the sentimental, as you described it. I think that's really, that's in a collector, that's extremely admirable to me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a sucker for most of these works, you know, unless I was bankrupt and, you know, I had to, as opposed to, you know, doing it from monetary gain, you know, but also, you know, it is kind of, you know, it is this romantic notion, isn't it, of, like, you know, never letting go of an artwork. And I've had conversations with collectors before who are like, look, I buy so much, I've bought so much, but I can't live with all of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to sell some of what I've bought so I can continue to keep buying and supporting other artists. So that's another way of looking at it.
You know,
forgetting all this flipping business, that's, you know, a different kettle of fish. But, you know, thinking about it from that way, from collectors being like, actually, you know, I supported that artist. You know, the time has come, you know, I don't need to live with the work anymore, but I'd like to be able to support some other artists. So I'm selling work. So, you know, I think that's fine too.
Right. So we're about a couple weeks out, almost literally, I guess, right? A couple weeks out from your fair.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess on one hand, I want to imagine that, you have been through this before, so you know it's how intense it's going to be and whatnot. But I mean, is there another part that's more like, I don't even know how crazy it's going to get as it approaches?
There's always the element of surprise
right.
at the fairs. Like, you just, when you think that you can never be fully prepared because there's always something random that's going to happen. For example, you know, last Pulse New York, we were set up, everything was great. And then the Wednesday evening before we opened on the Thursday morning for the brunch, there was a massive snowstorm.
Right.
So I was like, oh my goodness. You know, when you have a party and then you're like really, really nervous, you know,
yeah.
that no one's going to come.
Yeah.
So like that, that's pretty much actually how I get before all of the openings.
right.
I just get, you know, I get that panic. So, you know, the snow, I was like, crikey, we're doomed. But it was great. I mean, that's a great thing about New York as a city. It's resilient. You know,
right.
these New Yorkers are like, screw it. It's March. I'm over you, snow. I'm going out anyway.
Right.
So that was great. But no, it's always, I mean, it's exhilarating and exhausting all
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it affects you. It affects you different ways. So
yeah.
I just try and sort of stay healthy before the fair and try not to lose my voice because
right.
I'm just talking so much. That's always the thing that happens.
Me too. I can totally identify. All I have to do is go to a bar or party where, you know, everybody has to raise their voices. And like after an hour, I'm like, my voice is done, you know?
And that's it.
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, have you ever been over for the fairs in March?
No, I have. Well, here's the thing. I did live in New York before you did for a number of years.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And so I did go to the Armory back in the day. This must have been like mm-hmm. 98 or something, 99 maybe. And
yeah.
it was, you know, it was kind of as I described, you know, there was way too much. I'm sure I would have a better filter now and I would know what to avoid and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't gone, never been to Miami, nor do I necessarily mm-hmm. feel like I need to. But yeah, I mean, I'm basically, you know, one of these sensitive artist types who, you know, even if I were to recognize what I wanted to see, I would still have the weight of the stuff that's either mediocre or worse for me would just be kind of like, it would drain my energy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that's boohoo. But, but
well, at least you know that about yourself. So,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, it could change, but I mean, like if I was invited, you know, as an artist for a fair, of course I would go and then I would cross that bridge basically. But,
yeah.
But I guess, the thing that I want to ask you, though, going back to the fair approaching, is are you mm-hmm. sourcing the various, you know, advanced weather tools to just, you know, even though even if it snows, of course, you'll be fine just to get a heads up?
Yeah, I mean, there's shovels and snow blowers at the venue and,
right.
and salt and all that jazz. I mean, that's the great thing about New York. Everywhere's fully equipped.
Right.
But you know, the weather's been nuts here. It's snowing
exactly.
1 minute, it's going to be 50 degrees tomorrow. Like
right.
it doesn't make any sense. So my fingers are crossed that the snow has got it out of its system.
Actually, another thing I wanted to ask that arose when you were talking about getting through the regimen, or what's the word that I'm looking for? Having the fortitude, you know, to make it
mm-hmm.
through is just in case any new or, you know, maybe just first listening art fair professionals are hearing this. What
mm-hmm.
would you advise them for, you know, pacing themselves and, you know, and survival techniques and whatnot?
Survival techniques. Okay. So I am a big believer in hydration.
Right.
I know that sounds. I know that
any
sounds
particular
funny,
kind of
always...
hydration?
Pardon?
I just said any particular kind, like sparkling or flat, or anything more specific, or not necessarily.
Not necessarily, just water.
Right.
Bubbles or flat, whatever your preference. I mean, right. We work with Perrier, so that's amazing.
Okay.
But I think that staying hydrated and being fed is number one rule to helping you navigate an art fair or fairs. Because if you're thirsty or hungry, you know, that's not going to be a place where you want to. Where you want to hang out.
Right.
And I think it's just about taking your time, taking your time, taking breaks when you need breaks, asking questions, and conversing. I mean, it's really a community that sort of comes together at the fairs. So, you know, you can engage with them as much or as little as you choose to.
Right. You know, one of my favorite questions, I think, which I don't ask that often, but I think you're a perfect person to ask, and that is, where on the introvert extrovert spectrum would you say you are? Because I know you must, I know you've got to be on the extroversion side, but I don't think you're all the way on the end.
No. That's hilarious. I think that some people would say that I'm an extrovert, just in terms of some of the things that I like to wear and some of the opinions that I have. But I think at heart I'm an introvert. I can be pretty shy and reserved.
Right. Well, when I ask that question, and here's another way that you can think about it, because the technical definition of an extrovert and an introvert, you know, on the flip side, is that an extrovert gains energy from being around people, and an introvert loses energy from being around people.
Oh, then I'm a total extrovert.
There you go.
I love people.
Right.
I love being around people.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you got me.
I don't think. Yeah. Exactly. And I don't think you would be able to survive these art fairs if that weren't the case.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. No, I love the energy. I love all the exchanges. I love the. You know, the crazy and the calm people that surround me at that time.
So, right.
Yeah, I'm an extrovert then.
Beautiful. I don't think I have anything else. Is there anything that I neglected or you feel we would be remiss if we didn't bring up?
Yeah, I want to know whether you're an extrovert or an introvert.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for asking. I am definitely an introvert, but I'm on the side of that spectrum that is close to extroversion. So I definitely get a charge, I think, out of one-on-one and maybe the occasional two-on-one conversation. But like when I'm in an opening, you know, with that's really packed, that's like anxiety producing and whatnot.
Okay.
Yeah, poor baby. So if I'm talking to a bunch of people, I think I think if it's the right conversations, it can definitely be a nice charge. But if it's just sort of filler type conversations where you have to use that diplomacy and whatnot, I'm definitely going to be drained. You know.
Yeah, I got you.
Thank you for asking, though. That's very sweet of you.
Yeah, of course.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you, Helen, for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.
And we're out. Thank you again to Helen for speaking to me, especially right on the eve of the art fair, which I'm sure she is in full flight with as we speak. And she was very sweet, wasn't she? So I appreciated her getting us in before the madness of the fairs. And I hope you're enjoying the fairs if you're there. I want to remind you that before we get to my little tidbit about the Los Angeles gallery scene vis-a-vis New York Times and the follow-up to that, that this is a listener-supported show, and that means there are no ads. You heard no ads during this episode, correct? So all you're going to hear is me basically saying that this is a listener-supported show. Donations are extremely appreciated, and I love nothing more than going to my podcast email and seeing the notification of donation received subject line. So, and I mentioned in my last episode that my objective is to get one donation per week. This past week, I got three from Nefertiti, from Brian, and from Adam. So thank you very much to you guys, and I encourage you to join them. Of course, you can also support the show by following on social media, Instagram. I'm enjoying my communication with you guys on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And, of course, spreading the word is always very much appreciated. We are a tiny niche, and so the more word of mouth that we can get, the better. All right. So you may have been aware that the New York Times did a piece on the growth of galleries in downtown Los Angeles. And, of course, it ran in the style section. So that'll tell you a lot about what that whole thing is about. Let's just say there are a lot of celebrities involved in that conversation. But the thing that I wanted to share with you, which I assume you are not aware of or familiar with, is something that came out in the style section the following week. I get the New York Times on Sunday only and enjoy that ritual of reading the actual paper. So there was a correction, and I want to read it to you. An article last Sunday about the rise of art galleries in downtown Los Angeles misstated the age of the painter Sojourner Truth Parsons. She is 31, not 27. Gotta love that. You can't make that stuff up. And I don't know if you heard that. Sojourner Truth Parsons is her name. So first of all, I want to say, if you are a copy editor or fact checker that was involved with that piece, my sympathies, because I know you're getting it from all ends about how you made that mistake, even if you didn't or didn't have access to it, or if that's what you were initially told by the source in question. And for Sojourner Truth Parsons, I want to say, wow, if you told the paper that, in fact, they got your age wrong, that you're actually older than what they reported, good on you for doing that. So, and by the way, if you know Sojourner or you are Sojourner and you are listening to this episode, I would love to talk to you. So please get her in touch with me and the show if you happen to be connected in any way. All right, I think that's enough deconstructing of the correction section of last Sunday's New York Times. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to hearing from you in one way or another, and I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.